Position number 21296, wheel 1.
Alan Territory 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Sunderland.
Which year was this?
1925.
Did both your mother and father come from Sunderland?
Yes, they did. Though their parents, of course, had come from far afield as part of the great migrations of the 19th century.
Do you know where they came from?
Yes, one came from Whitehaven. I think my mother's parents came from Ireland. Because she was called Hagen, she had brown eyes and a terrible temper.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked in the shipyards as a carpenter.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Sunderland?
Yes, I did. I went to the local school, passed the 11 plus, went to the grammar school, went to university when I was 16. The war was, of course, on by that time.
You went to university at 16?
Yes, well, I think they were short of customers, because people were being called up at 18. And I had the necessary academic qualifications, so I took the bus through to Newcastle, went to the School of Architecture and asked if I could have a place, and they said yes I could, at a cost of £30 a year, which we didn't have, but my father dredged that up and we got started.
What was it like at the university in those days in the war?
Well, it was dominated. My life from 14 on, the war broke out when I was 14, life was completely dominated by the war. And I was evacuated, came home, joined the ARP as a messenger, became a senior messenger with a white hat and a special light on my bicycle. And then I joined the Home Guard, got to university, joined the Cadet Corps, and that really dominated our lives. It never occurred to me to question the war aims or anything of that nature. I've often said, if I'd been born in Bavaria, I'd have been in the Hitler Youth, you know, completely brainwashed by what was going on. I'm not saying that what was going on was wrong. I'm just saying it completely dominated our lives. Weekends were taken up with military training, summer camp with the Durham Light Infantry, and I joined the Royal Marines when I was 17 under Y scheme, which meant I wasn't called to the colours until I was 18, but I couldn't be drafted down the pits. I was already in the Marines.
Could I just go back to your evacuation? What are your memories of being evacuated, please?
Well, I was struck enormously by the difference between what I and my contemporaries thought about it all and what our parents thought about it. We went to a suburban station, and my Uncle John, whom I'd never seen for years, turned up to wave me off together with my mother and father. And all the women were crying and upset. But of course all the evacuees were either quiet, some were quiet, but mostly they were quite boisterous. It was a great adventure. And I got a brown paper bag with an apple, an orange and something in it, which we all consumed, of course, within the first 5 minutes. And we went to Northallerton, where we got out, and was shepherded into a large hall. It seemed like an aircraft hangar to me, but it was only a village hall. And at one end there were seats with rows of men and women on them. Then there were long tables behind which sat clerical people. And we all stood in a heap at the opposite end of the hall from the adults, were called forward one at a time, and were told with whom we'd be billeted. I was billeted with Mr. and Mrs. Hay, who had a grocer's shop. At the time I had an outbreak of impetigo on my face, which I think they thought was the Black Death. Anyway, I was closely questioned about that. And we did our schooling in the morning in the local school and in the afternoon in spare rooms around the town. I enjoyed it. I went from bottom of the class to top. Mine was a smaller class, so I was cheating, really. But I didn't like being evacuated. I felt I was missing the war, so after 3 months, my own school back in Sunderland was reopened, and I returned just in time for the bombing to start. I don't suppose it started without reason.
Can you describe what your experiences of the bombing was like, please?
Yes, I can. When war broke out on the 3rd of September, I had read in the paper that an air armada would approach England and would reach us in 7 minutes. I don't know where this information came from, but my bedroom happened to face the sea, and I went up and stood in the window looking at my Woolworths hexagonal watch, waiting for the bombers to appear. They didn't, but the ARP people turned out in force. My father, of course, was a warden. They all put on their gas repellent suits and their tin hats. Some of them put on their gas masks. It was quite a warm day. And after a couple of hours, they were all pretty hot. Anyway, there was no bombing. When the bombing really started, we'd already got our Anderson shelter installed. And we were near a railway station, a suburban station. And my mother said to her neighbour that, "Hey, they'll come and bomb the station." And as it happened, a lone Dornier came over, I think it was a Dornier, and it did drop a stick of bombs down our street, one of which hit the house two doors away. And I happened to be in the shelter at the time. And the wooden door, which my father had put on, burst in, and my mother said, "Hey, me house!" So there was weepings and wailings, but the house was still there, slightly damaged. But normally I was out in the air raids. I used to try to get from my bedroom to the ARP post before the sirens stopped. I forget now how long sirens wailed for, 3 minutes or something. And I usually got there just as the last tones were dying away. But the most important military duties I had were going to get the fish and chips, which of course was a very important function, to get the fish and chips. Interesting, I just thought of it now, after all these years. The fish and chip shops never closed. A.G.P. Taylor, in his History of Modern England, or his Modern History of England, refers to fish and chips being one of the reasons why there wasn't a revolution in the 30s. I think he's got something. You know, to get the fish and chips was very important and a great treat. So that was my contribution to the war effort at that time.
What was your address in Sunderland at the time?
3 Marina Avenue. Princess Marina was, of course, the Princess Diana of the age. My mother was deeply in love with Princess Marina, who, of course, we never met. And my father took the cricket bat, which he had made for me, and sawed the handle off and carved in it the words Alan Bray. And that was the name of our house, Alan Bray, 3 Marina Avenue. It was just the same as every other house on Marina Avenue, but it was called Alan Bray.
Did many bombs fall in your area?
Well, yes, a fair number. The bombs used to come over from Germany. At that time, my mother was running a small shop, and we used to eat in the back shop, and it was on the edge of the river, which was far below. The River Weir runs through a ravine, actually. And I remember being in the back shop and watching bombs bursting on the shipyard. I don't think it did a lot of damage. They were very small bombs. People did get killed. And then, of course, there was the stick of bombs that fell down our street. And they also used to fly over and fly down the coast. And I remember Lord Haw-Haw describing or intervening in a program where the BBC was describing how one of our fighters had shot up a German train, and he could see the driver of the engine, and Lord Haw-Haw cut in and said, "And he was wearing glasses and called Jones," which I thought was terribly funny. But anyway, these Dorners used to come over, and you could see the chaps in the front. They were virtually ground level, but they never did any damage. So there were a fair number of bombs. It was all very exciting, but life just went on, of course.
What, did the bombing have any effect on public morale?
You know, I don't think it had. You know, it was like the rain. You complained about it. We all got very excited when we actually got some AK-AK guns in Mowbray Park. And we all went up to watch the gunners digging in, establishing their guns. All the ladies came out and gave them cups of tea. And all the young ladies came out for quite a different reason. And we thought that was marvellous. There'd be no more bombing while we got our AK-AK guns. Of course, they never hit a thing, but it was very morale-boosting.
What do you think was the attitude to the Germans in the war?
I think aggressive, and I don't want to use the word hate, but I can't think of a better word. I mean, my mother used to say, "Bye, if I could get my hands on one of them chaps, I'd kill him," or something like that. And throughout the war, it was my constant feeling that members of the forces who were likely to get killed any minute, I'm not talking about the chaps making the sausage rolls, but the ones who were likely to get killed, didn't on the whole hate the Germans as much as the civilians did. And as for the civilians, I think the safer they were, the more they hated the Germans. We had a friend called Wanless, who was a big lad in the local Primitive Methodist Chapel, of which I was a member, and he was terribly religious. He just hated the Germans. He was a great advocate of bombing Russia with atom bombs in the middle of the night during the Cold War. He was quite serious about it. So I think there was a lot of dislike and hate of the Germans in the early days.
Why do you think that distance from the danger and the Germans increased the hatred then?
I think it's because people didn't know what they were talking about. I mean that in a literal sense, you know. Women like my mother would say, "Oh, I'd kill him." I mean, she wouldn't actually have killed anybody, couldn't have brought herself to do it. Though even as I speak, I've just been reading the history of the Second Balkan War, 1913, I think, and I think some of the women got pretty worked up at that time, and perhaps I was wrong. But I think British airmen who parachuted into Germany were often attacked, and I think any that landed in my district might well have been attacked.
What about the Home Guard experience that you had?
Oh, I defended the Sunderland and South Shields pumping station together with my cousin Harold, who I just visited last week. He's now 80. I remember we had an American Springfield rifle between us. It was all terribly Dad's army. The Home Guard experience at the college was different. See, that was at my home, that was within a mile of where I lived, and I volunteered to do duty with them. But at the college, the local cadet, our cadet force, was constituted as a mobile striking force. And we had an exercise once, and they actually brought a lorry. It was a builder's lorry, actually. And we all piled onto the lorry and drove to the town moor, which is all of 1 mile. And we got out late at night in the pelting rain, and were told to look out for German parachutists. I found a convenient compost heap in a nearby garden which had a sheet of corrugated iron on it. So I made myself a little shelter and spent the night comfortably asleep. And in the morning we all got breakfast. But we were told we had defeated the German parachutists, who never actually put in an appearance. And so we all felt gratified. But we were quite good at drill. We could shoot. We used to have an annual camp with the Durham Light Infantry, which was a proper regiment, and we had brain guns. So we were probably the best armed Home Guard unit in the region, and we did have a lorry. So we took it all seriously, and I think we're right to take it seriously. What I do know is we would not have stopped a German armoured column, but whether we would have died where we stood, I don't know. We were certainly well trained.
Can you give me some details now about joining up, please?
Yes, my principal concern was to get into the Royal Marines, because I saw the movie, the newsreel movie, of the early raids on Vågsø and Lofoten in Norway. I knew I'd have to go into the service, and I thought, that's what I'd like to do. I was convinced it was the right thing to do, and it sounded exciting, and it was the best, after all. You know, it seemed to me, if you're going to do anything, you should try and do it as well as possible, and with people who know what they're doing. So I wanted to do that. But as the war ground on, coal miners became more important than soldiers. Not as individuals, but the great shortage was of coal miners, and I lived in a coal mining area, and friends of mine were called up and sent down the pit. I didn't want that, so I went to Darlington, great adventure, was paid about 1/6 travelling expenses, and I joined the Royal Marines after some difficulty because I was half an inch too short. And the colour sergeant stood me in the measuring thing, brought down the rod on my head and said, 5'5¾" or something. And I said, oh, blimey, does that mean I can't go in? I'd gone with two pals, they were going in. So he said, well, these things vary a bit, you know. So they're all exactly the same, actually. So he stood me in the one in the next cubicle and banged the thing on my head and said, 5'6". So I was in. The interesting was, number two, a guy called Morgan, a particular friend of mine, had a hammer toe. So they wouldn't accept him in the Royal Marines either, but they put him in the infantry. He couldn't join the Marines on the basis that he couldn't march, but obviously that didn't matter in the infantry. And the third one, Tom McKenzie, who subsequently started an architectural practice in Africa. Big man, very impressive. But he just stammered like mad. I mean, he couldn't understand what he was saying. So they took him in and put him in the signals branch. It was quite funny. Anyway, we all got in. So when I was 18, of course, I was called to the colours.
What was the procedure for that?
Well, I'd had a medical and received the King's Shilling, or the equivalent of that, at Darlington. So all that happened was a buff envelope arrived, inviting me to, and a travel warrant, inviting me to go to Deal. I went to Newcastle Station at the appointed time, which was New Year's Eve, and I met there three of my friends who were also going to join the Marines, and we stayed together all the way down to Deal, where we were met on the station platform by a corporal who fell us in with our suitcases, marched us around the Royal Marine Depot, and we were locked in there for 6 weeks, quotes, until we learnt to wear the uniform. Interestingly, I was at a place called Chicks Bridge on the frontier between Kowloon and the Chinese territories some years later, when I received orders to go down to the dock and take passage for England. I was going to be demobbed. So I did that, and I met one of my friends with whom I joined up New Year's Eve years previously. So we went out together and we came back together and said goodbye at Newcastle Station.
So coming back to Deal, you were learning to wear the uniform?
Yes, that was what we were told. We were put into Victorian barracks, absolutely splendid barracks. We had to wax the floor every morning and bump it with a bumper. We had iron beds that came apart in the middle. It was a great prank, of course, to undo people's beds so they collapsed when they got in. And we were inspected night and day, rigorously. In the morning, the barrack room was inspected. I remember one more. Oh, there was a fireplace, which had to be whitewashed inside, because we couldn't actually, of course, have a fire. And there were fire irons, which were massive, and which had to be burnished every morning. And one morning, the officer came in with his sergeant. We all stood by our beds. And he said, Corporal, there's a barrack room corporal, bring me that poker. So that was done. He looked at the poker, looked along the length of it, rotated it and said, this poker's bent. Gave it back to the corporal and said, straighten it, and disappeared. So we instantly went to the next door barrack room, borrowed their poker, which was straight, and sure enough, matey came back. Corporal, let's have a look at the poker. So the poker was presented, and it was a straight poker, about an inch thick, solid iron. And the officer said, how did you straighten this poker, Corporal? And Corporal said, with my hands, sir. We, of course, were all chuckling. That was the end of that. But I learned an important lesson. That was pure bullshit. The officer knew it was pure bullshit, but honour was satisfied all round, so nobody got into trouble.
Any other memories from this time?
Oh, yes, lots. There was a man called Ashurst, who was a lieutenant. He was a right bastard, and he was in charge of our training. Now, I'm not against hard training. I did a brief period as an instructor at the Commando Depot at Achnacarry, and you wouldn't get anything harder than that. But he was sadistic. each of us had two pairs of boots, a pair covered with dubbin for field work and a shiny posh pair. And he'd get us all dressed up with our polished brasses and our best boots. And then he'd come onto the parade ground and start screaming, "Bombs falling!" And we all had to fall on our faces. And of course the toes of our boots used to get terribly scratched. He then used to inspect us and complain that we had scratched boots. And he also used to take us on totally pointless exercises, like marching at right angles to a railway line, which was in a deep cutting. And as the front ranks began to falter, realising there was a 30-foot drop in front of them, he'd shout, "I didn't order you to stop or halt or something," and we'd all have to toss ourselves down the one side and climb the other side. Anyway, as a result of his jollities, I ended up in hospital in order that we should learn what it was like to be in a pillbox being bombarded with high explosive from a mortar. He put us all in a pinbox and bombarded it with a mortar, a 2-inch mortar. And of course, when the bombs burst outside, the shrapnel came up, hit the underside of the slits, and ricocheted down inside. And I do remember I was sitting on the floor like everybody else, and the bloke in front of me said, "Could I get him a sandwich out of his pack?" We weren't supposed to have sandwiches in our packs, but he had one. And I put my arms forward to open his pack, and at that moment there was an explosion, and a piece of shrapnel ricocheted, hit the underside of the lintel, and came down, passed through my arm. So I had to go to hospital. I was soaking wet because we'd all been going through a canal. We went to hospital, they put me in a room with white tiles. And 4 hours later, somebody opened the door and said, "What are you doing here?" So I said, "Resting." And that was that. Anyway, I had a good time in hospital. That was very nice. But my experience of basic training in the Marines was, it was hard, as it should be, but there were people, undoubtedly, like this man Ashurst, who just enjoyed making other people miserable. However, years later, when I was at Achnacarry at the Commando Depot, we used to have a pastime called milling, which essentially was 2 teams of 10, the first 2 get into opposite corners of a boxing ring and beat each other senseless for a couple of minutes, then they jump or are dragged out and the next 2 jump in. And would you know it, Ashurst came up on the course. So we arranged that he was put in the ring with a particularly brutal chap for a lot longer than 2 minutes, so we felt, to some extent, the mills had ground fine, but justly.
What do you remember? You're just showing the scar on your right forearm.
That's what I call my British scar.
What do you remember happening next?
Oh, well, after hospital, I came out. I found most of my kit had been pinched by my comrades. And I was then told to go to Red Hill for a selection board, see if I could be an officer. So that sounded like a good idea. I went to Red Hill. I was there for 4 days, and I passed out, and then moved on to officer training at the Royal Marine Military School in a very posh hotel down at Salcombe in Devon. So I quite like, and that's jolly interesting. At the Royal Marine Military School, there were some expert instructors, and we dashed about and did energetic things that were shot at. We were literally shot at, and once I remember having to sit beside the target on a range while people fired at the target so that we could learn from the time gap between the crack of the bullet and the thump from the rifle, because you hear the crack of the bullet first, how far away the man shooting at us was. We got quite good at it. And of course we did lots of senseless drill. And on the final night, we did a night attack in Dartmoor, and I was put in charge for the approach phase. I was put in charge of the entire get-out forces. It rained all night, and I got everybody lost, but they forgave me.
Were you not very good at map reading?
No, I really wasn't. And I never got very good at reading a compass either. And during the war, being sent out on patrols, and one of them was quite a long patrol, I relied on my Sergeant Major Bevan. Of course, I didn't tell him I couldn't read a compass. I kept saying things like, "It's that way, isn't it?" And he'd say, "Yes, sir. Bit to the right, sir." I suppose I could read a map better than the average civilian could read a map, but I couldn't say I was an expert. But I knew the general direction.
What are your next memories?
Well, having qualified as an officer and got my snazzy suit from John Jones of Bruton Street, Mayfair, I was given 7 days leave. So I went up to London and found a large flying bomb had landed on John Jones of Bruton Street, Mayfair, so I didn't have enough uniform. So I went home in my battle dress, and my Aunt Lily said how well I looked or something, and I explained that my uniform had been blown up, and she said, "Oh, you mean like a proper officer?" I said, "Yes, that's the sort of thing." And the next thing after that was North Wales, running up and down Cader Idris and Snowdon, living in a bell tent with a lot of frogs to get fit, and then up to Achnacarry to the commando depot, which I loved. It was marvellous.
Why?
Well, very hard, but all the instructors were there to instruct. They weren't there to punish or to humiliate or be beastly in any emotional way. They looked as if and acted as if they generally wanted us to succeed in what we were trying to do. And that's very comforting. And I did the course, and then I had to stay on and be an instructor because I only was a second lieutenant and I was destined to join a commando group, and you had to be a full lieutenant. So I did a little bit of instructing.
Any details about the commando course at Achnacarry that we ought to record, please?
It was dedicated to turning ordinary soldiers into better trained soldiers. Much of the course was simply building up the heart and lungs. Very, very great emphasis on marching over hill and dale. We used to regularly march across the canal to Aberdeen on the other side of Scotland. Shooting, very, very good shooting course. Thompson submachine gun through tight foliage with targets popping up. And that was pretty good because I ended up with a Thompson submachine gun, and would you believe it, targets popping up. So I quite enjoyed that bit. And of course, living off the land and so on. So I thought it was a sensible course, a hard course, a very good course. Curious enough, it rained all the time, but I can't remember it raining, if you know what I mean. We just carried on. And I finished that course Christmas time, 1943, I suppose. Went home on leave and was called back from leave to go to Bexhill-on-Sea. And I was convinced that I was going to go to India. But when I got to Bexhill-on-Sea, I discovered we were going to go to Holland in about 48 hours. So I went into the town, but dead secret this was. Very, very secret. Nobody knew that the commando soldiers used to take their ammunition and their rifles and everything home. We're all in billets, nobody's in barracks. And this was so we could arrive and disappear at a moment's notice. I went into a shop in town with my coupon and my money to buy a scarf. And I sold a very nice khaki scarf, and the girl said, "You'll find it's very warm, sir, and you'll need it because it's cold in Holland." I nearly die laughing. Anyway, we all reported to the railway station at midnight, black dark. Sergeants and officers had torches, otherwise it was black dark. And I had, I think I'm right in saying, 10 or 12 men under command at that time, which was probably more than I deserved. And they were in two ranks, and I inspected the front rank with my little torch. When I got to the second rank, they were all sitting down. A couple of them were snogging with local girls. So I told them to stand up again. We sent the girls home. And we all went off to Tilbury, where a lot of bell tents were waiting for us, no frogs. And when I got there, I was one short. one of my chaps had a Piat, great big heavy iron anti-tank thing, and he was gone. He turned up later in the day. Apparently the train had stopped in the middle of the night at his local station. He could see his own house from the station. So he got out, went home, visited his wife, and caught up with us the next day. He still had his Piat. I thought it was quite a good show, didn't report.